Hello and welcome to the 90 Minutes or Less Film Fest. My name is Sam Clements and this is the podcast that celebrates films with a 90 minute or less runtime. In each episode, a guest will select a film and join me to add to our ongoing fictional film festival. Today, we are joined by filmmaker Jeff Wadlow, director of Truth or Dare, Kick-Ass 2, and the brand new movie Imaginary, which is in cinemas right now as this podcast drops. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Sam. I am so excited to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. And I love talking to filmmakers because I guess runtimes are something that you have to come up with. You deal with quite a lot in your day-to-day work.
I'm obsessive about runtimes. I think structure is so important to the kind of storytelling we do. And believe it or not, I become obsessed with the runtime at the script level, because I'm a big believer as a writer director that a page of the screenplay is a minute of screen time. So I'm already thinking, like, on page 10 of my screenplay, this needs to be minute 10 of the movie. This thing better happen. This person better say this thing. And I'm looking at the end. I know if it's a 104 page screenplay, that movie is going to be 104 minutes if I'm directing it.
Because you are a writer director on Imaginary, you co-wrote the screenplay as well as directed it. I guess you are doing the editing as you're typing, you know, and it's probably a lot easier to edit when you delete that paragraph, tear out this page.
No, and also I make movies. I don't make, you know, massive budget films, so it's incumbent upon me to make sure that I'm shooting the film that I want to edit, right? So there shouldn't really be anything left in the script by the time we start photography that I don't think is going to be on the screen.
You know the story intimately because you've been writing it, but also you get a sense of the pacing, which is so important, you know, when it comes to, you know, the very final product and people are actually sitting in cinema and watching this film.
Exactly. And I would say even some of the changes we make in editorial once the film has been shot are really no different and then the kind of changes I would make to the screenplay as I was developing it.
With Imaginary and developing that screenplay, where did this idea, you know, sort of first come from? Because you've introduced a spooky new character into cinemas with this film.
Yeah, you know, I love filmmaking because it's collaborative art. I love this idea that when we make a movie, we bring together a group of artists and technicians and we all add something to this incredible stew that I could never have imagined in a million years on my own. I mean, no disrespect to the giants of our industry who are auteurs, but I don't really believe in the auteur theory. I don't think any one person can imagine a movie in its entirety. What's fun about filmmaking is that we all come together and it takes on a life of its own. And for me, that usually starts at the conception level. And so on this film, I had been friends with Greg Erb for 20 years. I met him when I first got out to LA for film school. We lived in the same apartment complex around a crappy little swimming pool in West Hollywood. And we played flag football together and we just became buddies and we stayed in touch over the years. And when Fantasy Island was coming out, I had made this first look deal with Blumhouse and they wanted me to start generating more material for them. So I said to Greg, who, you know, had a very successful career as a screenwriter. He used to be Craig Mazin's screenwriting partner. His current screenwriting partner is Jason Ormond, who's incredibly talented. I said, hey, you guys want to do a genre film? I know it's not really in your wheelhouse, but if you got any ideas, let's sit down and beat them out. And so they came to my office at Blumhouse and I said to them, hey, I've always wanted to do an imaginary friend movie. They said, hey, we've always wanted to do an evil teddy bear movie and we want to call the bear Chauncey. And I said, well, let's see if there's a way for these two ideas to be melded together. And I'm so glad that we were able to figure it out because I think just an evil teddy bear movie wouldn't be enough really to merit a big theatrical release. And I think just an imaginary friend movie wouldn't be enough. But by bringing these two big ideas together, I think we've come up with something really fun and original.
It's something which is so familiar to kind of everybody who's been a child. You know, they may not have had a bear called Chauncey, but they would have had a favorite toy and a, you know, imagined, you know, playing with a toy and that sort of stuff. So it sort of has this familiarity, even though it is a brand new story, I think.
Yeah, and it really is a movie about imagination and childhood. It's not just about having an imaginary friend, because while a lot of people had imaginary friends, not everyone did. The truth is, I didn't really have a specific imaginary friend, but I had a very vivid world that I created, you know, with my G.I. Joes and my Transformers and He-Man, and I would stage these battles and these stories, and I would spend hours. And I think ultimately that's what the movie is about. It's about creativity as a child. And I think everyone can relate to that.
You mentioned a minute ago about working with Blumhouse, and, you know, they've got this amazing filmography behind them. You've worked with them a couple of times before this movie too. But I imagine with an idea like this and a company like Blumhouse, they must get excited when you make that initial pitch to them.
One of the reasons why they have such an amazing track record is, you know, they are really hard on their scripts and they vet those ideas very carefully. And it's a process. And it's not just Jason. He's got an incredible creative team, which is led by Cooper Samuelson. And it's an ordeal to get a movie greenlit over there. But that's the reason why they have such an incredible track record, is they know it's all about the script. It's all about the story. It's all about the idea. And if it's not working, no matter how small the budget might be, you shouldn't bother wasting your time on it.
Well, it's a sensible way to go into filmmaking, really, isn't it? And it benefits the audience at the end of the day. We get to see all of these amazing, you know, original ideas coming from that company.
Listen, it benefits the filmmaking process. I would rather have to have all the hard conversations about the story, about the characters, when it's just me and the executives and anyone else working on the screenplay. And then we all kind of lock arms and know we have a template for something we believe in. And then you go make it. And making a movie is hard enough. It's 10 times harder if you're trying to rewrite the screenplay while you're making the film. The film history is littered with disasters where they tried to rewrite the movie while they're making it. It almost never, ever works unless you have unlimited funds.
I wanted to ask a little bit about how you come up with your creature design in your films, especially in this film. You know, we've got some on the call, listeners. We have the titular character. We've got Chansey, one of the key players in the film. Very cool to see. How involved were you in the creature design, and what's that bit like for you as a filmmaker?
I mean, look, I'm very much a child of the 80s and the 90s, and I love that era of filmmaking when you know, visual effects were still largely photochemical. You know, you're just starting to get into some CG effects, and most everything was practical, or at least had a practical element. So I love practical creatures. I love monsters that feel and look real, not just for myself personally, but I think the way they affect the film. Like when an actor can actually see something and they're reacting to it, they have a much more authentic performance. I think the audience, when you show them something that has weight, that obeys the laws of gravity, that is interacting with light in a very real way that your mind can just sense, it creates this other level of verisimilitude that just helps the suspension of disbelief. So I guess the short answer is I love practical creatures and monsters. So I'm very involved in the designs. There's this fantastic creature designer named Mike Elizade, who started a company called Spectral Motion. And maybe 15 years ago, I took a meeting with Mike, or I should say Mike took a meeting with me, because I was developing this movie that had these robots in them. And the robots needed to be sort of, they needed to feel almost sort of like tinker toy in a way. Like, they need to feel very practical, and you needed to believe that people could beat them. Like, it was part of the conceit of the film. I won't go into a full pitch, but I wanted them to have a practical aspect to them. So I met with Mike, and he was very gracious with his time. I couldn't get the movie off the ground at that point, but I took a mental note. I was like, I want to work with this guy. He does all of Guillermo del Toro's monsters, all of James Gunn's monsters. And so not only on Imaginary, but also on Curse of Bridge Hollow, my last movie for Netflix, I was really lucky in that I was able to bring them on. And they, you know, there's so many monsters in Bridge Hollow that they were one of four creature shops working on that film. But Imaginary had a much smaller budget, but just as many demands. And I knew that Spectral Motion would really rise to the occasion and knock it out of the park. And they did.
I don't know if you've been in a cinema with an audience on Imaginary yet, but what's it like, you know, to sort of see how people are responding to these characters and to the movie?
I want to see my movie with an audience as much as possible before we lock the picture. I'm a huge believer in this idea that I don't make the movie for myself. I don't make it for my producers or the studio. I make it for the audience, because what we're actually making is not a movie. What we're making is the experience the audience has when they watch the movie. So I'm basically acknowledging that the audience is an active participant in the process, that the final product isn't created until they've seen the film. So I love sitting in an audience with a movie, not because it's a pleasant experience. Often it's hell because all your mistakes are just, they're so obvious when you're watching it with an audience. And then you get surprised by some things that you didn't think were mistakes. And suddenly you're like, oh my gosh, that didn't work at all. So it's quite painful. Don't get me wrong, but I love doing it because it's such a critical part of this, of the filmmaking process, in my opinion.
Does a film's runtime ever come into your decision-making process? I don't know if you get to go to the cinema so much if you're busy working, but yeah, do you ever look at how long a film might be and does that ever sway you?
Not so much. I mean, as we live in this age of really long movies, I hate to say this because I am such a proponent of the theatrical experience, but if a movie is over 2.5 hours, you know, if it's pushing 3 hours and I know it's going to be streaming in 3 weeks or whatever, it's kind of hard to commit to the theatrical experience on that film. Because I'll be honest, you know, I love all of Scorsese's films. I liked watching The Irishman in like 3 sittings. It was really satisfying. It was like one of the best miniseries I'd ever seen. And now I'm sure I would have had a different experience if I'd watched it in a theater, but I don't know. So I guess the short answer to your question is normally no. Normally, I don't really look at the runtime. I just like to go in blindly and enjoy myself. But with my own movies, I am so obsessed with the runtime. Like when I'm editing it, every week I have the assistant editors write on an index card what the current runtime is, because it's not as easy as you think. It's not like a movie where you can just like look on the computer and see how long it is, because we work in reels. So it takes like a moment to add up the runtime of all the reels and the logos and what we think the crawl is going to be to kind of calculate that. We call it the TRT, the total runtime. But I actually have them on every Friday, put it up on a note card and put it up on my bulletin board. And I don't like them to take the old ones down, so I can sort of see how the movie's evolving.
But I love that you keep this sort of analog running total to see where you get to.
Yeah, no, it's really important. Because ultimately too, you know, filmmaking, unless you're Scorsese, is a collaborative process, as I keep coming back to. And you have to be able to talk about the pacing of the film. You have to be able to defend choices you're making in editorial, and having that sort of piece of information right up on the bulletin board by my desk can be very helpful when I'm having those conversations.
Oh, nice. Well, I definitely appreciate your services to Runtimes. Thank you, Jeff, on that front. Before we talk today, we gave you a little bit of homework to pick a under 90-minute film to add to our film festival. How did you go about your homework? How did you you sort of research which film to choose for us today?
I just started Googling around, you know, movies that were 90 minutes or less. And just looking at the titles that I recognized and was surprised by some of them, I was like, wow, I didn't know that movie was that short. I wanted to pick a movie that I had already seen. I didn't want to discover a movie for this. I also wanted to pick a movie that people would have heard of, but isn't just like so ubiquitous and so in the zeitgeist that everyone knows everything about that movie. So I was trying to walk this line of selecting a film that was both familiar, but maybe a little bit forgotten. When I realized this film was on the list, it sparked a memory for me. And I actually have a very fun little anecdote about this film that I want to share with you about the runtime.
I think you did a fantastic job. You threaded the needle so well. That is exactly what we want on this festival. And I think you picked a banger. I think it's time to reveal that film though, Jeff.
I picked the 1985 action classic, in my opinion, that is, I believe, exactly 90 minutes, Commando. Starring Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Retired Delta Force operative Colonel John Matrix, Arnold Schwarzenegger, lives a secluded life with his daughter, Alyssa Milano. When she is kidnapped by a brutal former team member seeking revenge, Matrix must travel to South America to get her back. Somewhere. Somehow. Someone's going to pay! Exclamation mark. Beautiful brief blurb on the back. Always nice to read those out. And a very nice package. The picture actually looks really good as well in HD. They've done a nice job with the transfer.
You know, it just occurred to me, hearing you read out the synopsis, that whoever wrote the Liam Neeson movie Taken probably owes Jeff Loeb a little bit of money, because that's basically Taken, right? I mean, that's the premise for Taken. He has a special set of skills and they take his daughter.
The film was originally released in 1985, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger, also co-starring Ray Dawn Chong, Alyssa Milano, Vernon Wells, Bill Duke, and music, incredible music by James Horner. Jeff, where did you first watch this? Was it a TV watch for you?
Well, wait, don't forget that cast too. Dan Hedaya, Bill Paxton is in the movie.
Oh yeah, so nice to see like Bill Paxton scene in there.
I know. I mean, he's like one scene. It's clearly like early in his career. I love that when you spot a big actor playing a small part earlier in their career. It's like Richard Dreyfuss has one line in The Graduate. He like leans in the room. He says, well, I'm going to call the cops. Like when that happens, it's such a jolt of excitement. I'm like, I don't know who exactly that person is. So it was fun to see Bill Paxton. And I didn't realize he was even in it until I rewatched the film. Where did I first see it? I definitely saw it on HBO. It was one of those movies that was just on repeat on HBO. I wasn't really allowed to go to the cinema and see rated R movies, but I watched it on HBO. I mean, I probably learned more about sex and violence and swearing from HBO than any other person or source, because it was just totally unfiltered and it was on all the time, all the time. I mean, Commando would be playing at like 10 a.m. on a Sunday on HBO. And my parents had no idea. And I would just go. And also it was such an analog time where, you know, you didn't have DVRs. And so you would just go and turn on HBO and whatever was on, you watched. And truth be told, I've probably seen the back half of Commando at least three times as many times as I've seen the first half of Commando, because I would always turn it on, it would be playing, and I would just sit down and watch it.
I think I have that similar experience from seeing it on TV, and it was always on Saturday nights in the UK. Like it was one that they'd always like rotate around the action film, so Commando would come on a lot. But yeah, I feel like I would always join from the last 25 minutes, so I sort of know the siege, Arnie's one-man siege, really, really well, and the rest of the film less well.
Well, that's the money, right? That's everything. Like when he puts on the face paint and he's got the vest. I forgot how weird it is that he rose to the island in like a Speedo.
Yeah.
Like, remember that? I mean, that's like such a weird choice. Like, why did he do that? Like, did he get in the water? I don't think he did. I feel like he just pulls up. He's in a Speedo. He gets to the shore and he puts on his stuff on the shore. I don't know why. Like he's going to take the time to put on makeup. Well, so much of it doesn't make sense, but it's still so much fun.
Absolutely. It's part of the ritual, part of the fun. The thing about putting on the paint for me is it's like broad daylight.
Yes.
I don't know if you need the camo on either.
And thank you for correcting me and calling it paint. I'm sure Arnold would be very offended hearing me refer to it as makeups.
So is this a film that sort of you just sort of through osmosis, I guess, because it was on TV so much, you just got to know more and more just through being an HBO watcher?
Yeah, there's a handful of movies that fall into that category. Red Dawn, Rocky IV. Oh, I've probably seen Rocky IV 50 times. It was just on HBO so much in that period in my life. You know, before I had a driver's license, there was no internet. Like, what are you going to do? You know, you're going to walk to the comic book store and you're going to come back. You're going to like turn on HBO. I mean, it was the best way to see movies uninterrupted by commercial. I honestly can't tell you when I saw it from beginning to end, because I just watched it, you know, and basically wherever the movie was, I watched it to the end so many times.
Was watching, you know, I guess like it being introduced to films on TV, was that, you know, what sort of sparked an interest in you becoming a filmmaker yourself?
For sure. I mean, it was kind of a hybrid of comic books and action figures and accessibility to films, DVDs, VHS tapes, collector VHS tapes. Like I had that original Star Wars box set with the hologram on it before they started messing with them with the visual effects. But I always knew I wanted to be a filmmaker. You know, I walked out of Empire Strikes Back when I was like, you know, 4 years old, 5 years old with my father. And he tells the story, I don't remember it, but he says, I turned to him and said, what does a director do? He said, well, you know, he talks to the actors, he decides where the camera's going to go. He's kind of in charge of telling the story. And I said, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I got to watch this film, I think as it was intended, you know, on like a Saturday night at home, watching it with my wife. She actually left the room briefly when Bill Paxton was on screen. I was like, you missed Bill Paxton.
And his, by the way, just a quick, sorry to interrupt, but his voice, the way he talks, that sort of like cadence to his speech is so specific, and maybe it just sounds like another American to you, but for me as an American, it's really unique. Nobody talks like Bill Paxton. I don't know where that accent comes from. I guess it's got a little bit of a surfer quality to it. You know, I just hear him so clearly in Alien saying, "Game over, man, game over." But he actually speaks in Commando before you see him. And I kind of was like, on my couch, I went, "That's Bill Paxton." And then it cuts and it's Bill Paxton.
What really struck me on sort of when I was rewatching it for this was, it is the most economic action film. Like, there's no messing around. In the first, 30 seconds, we see some Uzis and some people die. We have that amazing, shot with the garbage men and that sequence. But very quickly, we get onto like a sitcom-esque opening title sequence, which I love how economical that montage is over the opening titles.
It's funny. It's terribly executed, but it totally works because, in many ways, I can't remember where I heard this quote, screenwriting is the art of efficiency. And that also translates to the screen. So you want to figure out a way to get your ideas across as concisely as possible. Hence our mutual appreciation for a concise running time. So what's great about that credit sequence is you're like, I get it. This guy who looks like a man of violence. I mean, he's a beast. Loves his daughter, and he's got this sort of goofy, sweet energy with her. And you just sort of get it. And you're like, yeah, I understand this. I understand their relationship. I understand their dynamic. I don't need to know anything else.
It was a real sort of like punch the air moment for me. Like, oh, it's such a good way to set up a relationship without needing to spend, actual like story time, hearing dialogue scenes with them or, seeing them do an activity together. We can just get straight into the movie afterwards.
And not to shamelessly promote my own film, but we do something similar in Imaginary where we have this problem developing the script. You're like, okay, well, if our lead character grew up in this house and something happened, and even we saying her memories are kind of fuzzy, why would she want to move back into that house? It makes no sense. And so we came up with this notion that it was like her happy place, that all her happy childhood memories are associated with that house, despite this one sort of mysterious thing that happened. And we're like, well, how do we convey that? Credit sequence.
It's a gift to filmmakers, I have to say.
Yeah.
Also, must be quite fun to just film those, dialogue-free scenes with these actors.
No, it's the opposite. It's the bane of production. Producers, physical production producers hate those kind of sequences. They hate montages because, with like a 3-page dialogue scene, it's what, between 3 and 5 setups. When you're doing a montage, like a credit sequence like that, every moment is a different setup. It's a different scene. It requires something else from the art department. You got to move the camera. I mean, it's a huge drain on production resources. So they're actually not a pleasure to shoot. And I've had to fight to keep them in movies in the past.
Oh, I appreciate you doing that. And I didn't realize, but of course, when you actually say it out loud, of course, that's totally right. These are 10-second, 5-second shots sometimes. And it's a lot of gear to move around for those.
You got to go to a different place. You got to get more stuff. You got to like light it. It's a whole thing.
Got to get Arnie another tree trunk to carry around.
Yeah. that sequence is so ridiculous. But it's also so great. And it's funny. He's just like, you can feel him figuring out acting in that film. Like I don't have his filmography up in front of me right now, but I obviously, he played the Terminator before that. And so he kind of had done the heavy. And so you could tell he was trying to figure out like how to be the leading man while still maintaining that heavy energy. And I've started watching the Arnold documentary series. I've only gotten through the first episode, but it's an incredible piece of filmmaking, kind of getting inside his process and understanding how he evolved this persona. And you can see that Commando is in a very important step in that process.
Yeah, it does feel like a bit of a crossover film from his career. Like it feels like he's pushing himself a bit more. There's more dialogue in this. He introduces, I think, his first two on-screen quips, that sort of Arnie humor, which we get to know and love as he progresses. But he can still deliver on the action scenes. And there's some really challenging physical moments in this film also.
Yeah. Yeah. It's old school. There's no wire work. There's no green screen. There's no trickery. I mean, everything you see he's doing. And some of it's awkward, and you can tell that there you could do a better version of it now, but it really is still just a testament to his charisma and his athleticism, the way he pulled it off.
Could you tell me what this is all about?
Yeah, a guy I trusted for years wants me dead.
It's understandable. I've only known you for 5 minutes and I want you dead too.
The film doesn't waste any time in getting started. As soon as that title sequence is over, you know, a visit from his old boss saying there's some bad dudes out there. And then literally as soon as his boss leaves, the helicopter is still in sight. The bad guys show up and all hell breaks loose. And then the plot really gets to go. And it's this amazing, you know, like the rescue mission, like the back of the box says.
It's easy to point out the sort of goofy things about a movie like that. But I also want to shine a light on some of the really inventive moments. One that sticks out for me as a screenwriter is the concept, really the conceit of the whole movie is that, you know, he gets on this plane and it's an 11-hour flight and he kills his captor and he sneaks off the plane and he sets his watch and he knows he's got 11 hours before the bad guys realize he's still in the States. That is a great action thriller setup.
Absolutely. And I think, as an audience, we get even more invested, you know, showing as a good filmmaking technique, us being able to see a literal countdown on Arnie's wrist, you know, throughout the movie is so good.
As screenwriters and storytellers and filmmakers, we're always talking about like a ticking clock. How can you put a ticking clock in a movie? And it is a kind of a cliche development note, and often they're ham-fisted when they're put in stories. But this is a story that has a wonderful ticking clock that's unique. I'd never heard of that kind of setup before. Like the ticking clock is based on a flight that they think he's on. It's really kind of brilliant. And I sort of ripped it off for a movie that I developed that hasn't been made yet. This is a bit of a scoop. I've developed this movie with my friend Chris Roach, who wrote Nonstop for me, which I was a producer on. And then Chris and his wife Jill wrote Truth or Dare and Fantasy Island with me. I developed this movie with him called Throttle. And the premise was that you have a Monaco Grand Prix driver. And right before the Monaco Grand Prix starts, he gets a message that his family has been abducted. And they say, unless you throw the race, we're going to kill your family. And so he does one lap, then he pulls over and his protege, who's not been allowed to race because this guy's a little bit older and he took the spot, he goes into the tent with his protege. He's like, you got to put on my suit. You got to put on my helmet. You're going to run the race. And that means I have the length of time that the race is going on to now run around Monaco and try to find my family and stop these guys. So I love that kind of that structure that's tied to a finite amount of time. It just immediately puts the audience on the edge of their seat.
Oh, that sounds incredible. And yeah, it's just a really good way to draw the audience in. And, you know, like we understand the limitations or the deadline that the character needs to hit. And I don't know, we're sort of a bit more invested in Arnie's task after this. I love that he escapes as the plane is taking off through, you know, the like luggage section and jumping off the landing gear. Again, a great like physical filmmaking.
Yeah, he's just superhuman. I mean, how about like when he like breaks the chain and lock with just his hands?
Yeah.
And can anyone do that? I don't care how strong. Can any man on the planet do that? I mean, that seems insane, but he does it and just happens. You're like, yeah, of course, look at him. He can do that.
But it leads into that shopping mall sequence, which I really love. You know, Arnie's first of at least two, you know, action sequences in a shopping mall throughout his career. And you get to see him, you know, he's sort of spotted by the bad guys. They realize he's not on the plane, but he has to lift a phone box up with a man inside. And that's Arnie doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I would have to analyze it a little bit more to kind of figure out what the trick is that allowed him to do that. What's interesting is there must be more visual effects in the film than we're realizing right now. I mean, obviously there's the bad blue screen when they're on the plane, but when I was reading up on the film, it was nominated for best visual effects, I think, at the Saturn Awards, and it lost to Back to the Future. So, I mean, there must have been more going on than we're giving it credit for, but I would argue that that is actually the mark of brilliant visual effects, because you shouldn't be looking at them. You should just be in the movie, and clearly we were.
Yeah, it feels like you're in the trenches with Arnie, and you know we're really invested in what that character does. It's a bit like a road movie or like an on-the-run movie, you know, buddying your character up with an unwilling accomplice. Ray Dawn Chong is such a good someone for Arnie to sort of go on this journey unwillingly, and a really great companion for him.
Yeah, it's sort of a precursor to Bourne, which did it really well. And I'm trying to think of some other movies where they did it, but it's a good dynamic, the sort of unwilling buddy. And I like that the movie doesn't get romantic. I mean, there's a little bit of a spark between them you can feel, but it's not on the page and it's certainly not overt. I thought they played it really well. And she's great in the movie, and the way they kind of figure out where the island is, and you see that she's adding value to the partnership, that she's not just some damsel in distress he's dragging along. I thought it worked. I mean, there is a moment in the movie, when she's sort of transitioning from hostage to partner, there's like a scene or two where you're like, really, really? Wouldn't she just get out of there? But once that turn happens, they're wonderful on screen together.
Yeah, she sort of goes, maybe it's a little bit clipped. Maybe that's something where a little bit, a couple more scenes together, we could really see, her sort of soften or sort of become part of the journey. But it definitely works, from the audience's point of view. And I do love that she gets to fire the rocket launcher before Arnie does.
Yeah, well, and also she's got that great line. I wrote it down. Where is it? Cindy, can you tell me what this is all about? Matrix. Yeah, a guy I trusted for years wants me dead. Cindy, that's understandable. I've only known you for 5 minutes and I want you dead too.
It's like zingy, screwball, that rat-a-tat sort of 1930s, 1940s dialogue.
It's super fun. I mean, and I don't know who really gets credit for that. Jeff Loeb wrote the original draft, and, I think Steven D'Souza did a big rewrite on it for Arnold. Yeah, it's just a great mixture of action with just enough humor that it allows you to have fun. And I think movies should be fun. I don't think they should be these dirges, right? Like I'm very much of sort of the Richard Donner school of filmmaking, which is no matter how serious the content is, there's going to be levity. I mean, people dying of cancer still make jokes. It's like this is the human experience, and I think it's really important to bring that to the screen.
It helps your characters feel more human as well, and it just sort of helps with pacing. I think between the adrenaline fueled action scenes, we need a bit of light relief.
Yeah, as long as you don't sell the stakes. The rocket launcher moment with Ray Dawn Chong borderlines on selling out the stakes. Like, really, your choice in this moment to free your friend is to fire a rocket launcher at the vehicle carrying him? Like, that just doesn't seem like it's a good idea. And it, by the way, if I had been making that movie, I would have had a moment of Arnold getting out of the van and being like, you shot a rocket launcher at me? Like, why would you do that? Well, I don't know. I was trying to save you. And you thought saving me was going to include firing a rocket launcher? Like, I mean, I think I would have called that out. It's not the best plan, Cindy.
Yeah, I mean, the odds are surely quite slim. He's in the back as well, right? Like the bit that you
shot. Where's she shooting it?
I like how they sort of lay, it's just a line, I think, but they sort of lay the groundwork that she wants to become a pilot. And then before you know it, she's having to fly a seaplane.
By the way, it's good. That's good writing. That's an arc for her, right? I mean, that's good writing. And it shows again that she has a purpose. She's not just some the girl, right? So many of these movies from that time period, there's just the girl. And it's a real disservice to strong female characters that have, that can be and have been created in film history. And I think they got it right with her character. I mean, she's still a supporting, lead. It's still his movie, but I think the character is wonderfully scripted and she plays it perfectly.
And I think it shows that she's integral to Arnie's mission here. There's a couple of times where he wouldn't have succeeded if it wasn't for her.
Well, listen, you said it perfectly. She's integral to the plot, right? And if you're making a movie that's 90 minutes or less, every element has to be integral to the plot or it shouldn't be there. I have to tell this story. And this is one of the reasons why I picked this movie. So Joel Silver was a mentor of mine for a number of years. I made a bunch of pilots with him. I developed Nonstop, the Liam Neeson movie with him. And he is a larger than life, iconic producer, just a seminal figure in Hollywood, produced Die Hard, Lethal Weapon, Predator, The Last Boy Scout. I mean, I once went to his Frank Lloyd Wright estate in South Carolina, and he has this car barn filled with all these vintage cars and just movie posters, three rows lining all four walls. And he turned to me and he said, my job is to collect movie posters with my name on them. And I was like, yeah, that's a perfect way to describe your job, Joel. So I had this very close relationship with him for a number of years. And he told me so many incredible anecdotes. But one of the anecdotes he told me was that on Commando, which I think it might be his first solo producing credit. It was early in his career. I don't think it's his first producing credit, but certainly it might be his first solo producing credit. He makes this movie and it was like, I think he said the runtime was like 86 minutes when it was done. And he was mortified because he felt if it was under 90 minutes, it wasn't like a real movie for theaters. It had to be at least 90 minutes. That was like the minimum. And he was embarrassed. So when they were delivering the film, you have to create all this paperwork when you finish the film called the deliverables, right? It's like the clearances, the contracts, you know, it's everything, right? It's just like, it's binders and binders of paperwork, legal documents. And this was obviously a pre-digital age. So, you know, it's all filled out by hand or on typewriters and photocopied and things like that and all on paper. And on one of the deliverables is there's just a form where you have to list all the sort of basic information about the film, like what was it shot on, what, you know, what was it finished on, all the tech specs. And there's a box for like, how long is the movie? And Joel was so embarrassed that it wasn't 90 minutes that he lied. He wrote 90 minutes for the runtime and it wasn't 90 minutes. And so for like years and years and years, you would get like a VHS copy of the movie and it would say runtime 90 minutes. And the tape, the movie's not 90 minutes long. And so I don't know how eventually they fixed it because, you know, if you look at the computer file, I bought it on iTunes and it is 90 minutes long. They must have like stretched some shots or made the crawl a little bit longer to like get it there. But there was a period of probably well over a decade where anywhere you looked up the runtime, it said 90 minutes and the movie was 100% not 90 minutes long.
Oh, that's incredible. What a good tidbit.
Isn't that fun?
But also, like, sometimes, you know, admin is never the most exciting bit of doing a movie, I would guess. But it has that's what impacts the legacy of your movie. And data gets duplicated and people make copies and buy copies. And, you know, it could have the wrong runtime printed on the back.
Yeah. I mean, now it's easy to check in this digital age. But back then, it's like, who's going to check? Who's going to sit down and time a movie?
John, I'm not going to shoot you between the eyes. I'm going to shoot you between the balls.
Let off some steam, Bennett.
You said you watched the film just last night. Was there anything that sort of really stood out to you on this latest watch, which you maybe didn't appreciate as much before?
Yeah, just like how much fun that movie must have been to make. Like they were in all those real places. I mean, yeah, they cobbled together the estate from different locations, the Hearst Castle, Benedict Canyon. I mean, they were in different places. That's what we do as filmmakers. But they like went to all those places with the cameras and the blanks and the firearms. And they just like, it just looked like it was a, pun intended, a blast, you know, to like set up those explosions and run around with guns. And I want to be super clear about something. Like I am very anti-firearm. Like I don't believe in gun culture. Like I don't think there's any reason why anyone should ever own a gun. So I just want to be clear on that point. That being said, you know, I loved G.I. Joe. I loved sort of the fantasy of military adventure the same way I love the fantasy of knights fighting dragons, right? So it must have just been fun to sort of participate in this fantasy of like being a larger than life military action badass fighting this like mercenary terrorist army that is on an island off of Santa Barbara. I mean, I was just sort of struck by how much fun they must have had making this movie.
Just coming up to 40 years old, but it's still so spectacular when, you know, you finally get to that big siege and, you know, before you know it, Arnie's blowing up whole buildings. You know, yeah, you have these amazing effect shots with like models in front of them being blown up and all that.
Yeah, you can see the mannequin stands holding the guys up in front of the buildings when they blow up. And also I started realizing they're using the same stuntmen over and over and over again in that siege. Like when the squib hits and flying through the air, they would just like put a mustache on the same guy because they're all wearing like green military fatigues. But we keep talking about the silly, cheesy stuff. But I just want to keep stressing that I do not think this is a silly, cheesy movie. This is not like a B movie, like ripe for Mystery Science Theater 3000, whatever that show is called. Like this movie still works despite the fact that you can see the seams in places.
Absolutely. I think when you're in it, the film is so impactful. And by this point as well, you're so invested in Arnie. We keep getting these sort of like glimpses of his daughter with the villain and, you know, like we're willing him on. But you're totally right. You know, I think when you say some of these things out loud, like with a lot of action films, it does sound a bit silly. But when you're watching the film, it's so effective. And I don't think it's lost any of its impact, you know?
No, it's so much fun. And a lot of it is the pacing and the stakes. If you have great stakes and characters that you care about, the audience will forgive all that, all the mistakes and problems, whatever the issues are. If they care about the characters and there are stakes for those characters, the audience will stay in it. And to your point about like just continually cutting to Alyssa Milano, seeing her like trying to escape, seeing Bennett stalking her with that terrifying hunting knife, like that keeps you leaning in, and you care about Matrix getting there in time. So it's not just like gratuitous action. You're like, come on, you got to save her. And it's great casting. I think it was either Billy Wilder or Warren Beatty said that 80% of directing is casting. And the movie is so well cast. And you just know it by the fact that so many of those actors went on to have very long careers. I mean, can you imagine a cuter kid than Alyssa Milano, a more precocious, wonderful little girl than Alyssa Milano at that moment? I mean, they built a whole sitcom basically around her with Who's the Boss. So obviously you want her to be saved. You're desperate for her to be saved.
And Bill Duke so good, and Vernon Wells as Bennett, and I do, you know, you have a really great climactic fight scene from the spectacle of the beach and those big houses to, you know, some like plant room underground somewhere, and it's very confined,
it gets small and personal, which is a great trick. Like it's a common mistake that people think like finales need to get bigger and crazier. And that's not true. The stakes need to be raised, but it doesn't necessarily mean in size. And so it's very personal, very intimate characters, you know, mano a mano, the little girl right there, knives, you know, fighting with knives. I mean, it feels like an escalation, even though it's gotten more contained and smaller in scale.
And quite a meaningful death of the villain as well. Like, you know, it's pretty brutal.
Let off some steam. Bennett is one of the great action movie one-liners of all time. Because it's both like specific, but also just has that sort of generic action movie feel. Like, I mean, I would offer it's probably even better than I'll Be Back, because when you say let off some steam, Bennett, I know exactly the moment you're talking about. When you say I'll Be Back, I'm like, yeah, that's been said like, you know, now probably a dozen times in Terminator movies. Obviously the first time is the most iconic, but I can think of all the other ones. But yeah, it's a great, great moment.
Very glad to have Commando in our 90 Minutes or Less festival. Thank you, Jeff, for contributing that. What we like to do, you know, we are a film festival. We're going to put these films on at a cinema one day, God damn it. And I'd love to ask you if I could give you a print of this movie and, you know, a blank check to book a theater or a venue of your choice. Is there anywhere where you would personally like to screen Commando, like to watch a Commando with an audience?
That is a great question. You know, I've never seen it in a theater. Yeah. I mean, it came out in 1985. I was, you know, 9 years old at the time. So I've never seen it in a theater. I would love to see it in a theater. I think I would say, you know what, if I could just do anything I want, we're gonna screen it at the Hearst Castle. I know they shot a chunk of the movie there. So let's screen it there. That's an incredible venue. And I would pay everyone who worked on that movie, actors, cast, crew, writers, anyone who had anything to do with that movie, I would pay them whatever fee I need to pay them to get them to come back and like watch it with us. And, you know, obviously we'd get Arnold to talk, and we'd get Lester, the director, to talk, and Joel Silver and Jeff Loeb and Radon Chong. But then I would also want to then have like a barbecue afterwards where like everyone can just mix and almost make it like a reunion for everyone who worked on the movie. And Alyssa Milano, I just want everyone there. And I just want to be able to ask some questions about it and just watch them, you know, kind of talking about making the movie together. I just think that would be a lot of fun.
Oh, wow. I love that, the idea of a reunion. I think the 40th anniversary is coming up next year. You know, this feels like something that should happen.
Yeah. No, it would be great. I mean, look, it's a funny movie because, again, it's so easy to point out the sort of the seams of it. but I still think the movie works. It's also an important movie to give some context to, because obviously the sort of the over militarization of our culture is a bad thing, and it's obviously glorifying that. So I think you have to be a little bit careful about how you treat it. But it is sort of this wonderful guilty pleasure, and it does, I think, I do believe that it does serve like sort of this important inflection point in Arnold Schwarzenegger's career, who is clearly one of the biggest movie stars of all time.
Totally agree with that. I mean, this bit of film history, this, you know, the 80s with these action stars is so interesting. There's a great book that came out last year called Last Action Heroes by Nick DeSemlin, who's been on this podcast previously. And it talks about, you know, how competitive the Stallone was and Schwarzenegger was. And,
yeah,
you know, this is Schwarzenegger's Rambo, you know, even down to being John Matrix.
Well, first of all, it came out the same year as Rambo 2, right? Mm. Both came out in 1985. You have to remember that, you know, today's sort of draws to the cinema are visual effects, right? It's a chance to see superheroes and dragons and these things that are just larger than life. But before we had the ability to create those images, the things that were larger than life were these guys. It was Arnold. It was Stallone. It was Van Damme. They did not look real. They looked like special effects. And so that was the draw. That was the thing that was bigger than me, bigger than you, bigger than anything we could see that would bring us to the cinema.
100% agree there. And yeah, you're right. Absolutely right. Well, I am glad that we will be able to get Commando in our fictional film festival on the big screen. Love the idea of screening at Hearst Castle. You know, let's go really big with this one.
They went big on the explosions. We should go big on our screening.
Give Commando the respect it deserves and yeah, reunite the cast. I think that's fantastic. Thank you so much, Jeff, for talking to us today. Thank you for picking, I think it's our first Arnie film in the festival. We've already got a Stallone. We've got Cobra, which is a similar runtime. So now we've got Arnie and Stallone from the 80s together side by side.
Perfect. Well, thank you for having me, Sam. It was both a challenge and a pleasure to participate. I think it's a great podcast that you're doing here, and I look forward to seeing future films that make it into the 90 minutes or less canon.
Oh, awesome. Thank you, Jeff. And we should say, you know, listeners, as you're listening to this, Imaginary is in cinemas right now, and it's definitely a film to see on the big screen with an audience. You know, take your mates. You'll have a great time.
Longer than 90 minutes, but still not that long. I think the total runtime is like maybe, I want to say like 107 minutes right now. I don't remember it exactly off the top of my head, but yes, it is concise in its storytelling, and I do think you'll have a fun time at the theater.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Thank you, Sam. Take care, bud.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your podcatcher of choice so you'll never miss an episode. You can also leave a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and if you have a moment, why not share an episode with your friends? Every recommendation helps. You can contact us on our website, 90minfilmfest.com, and you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at 90 Min Film Fest. The podcast is produced by me, Sam Clements, and Louise Owen. It's edited by Louise Owen, with sound mixing and additional editing by Luke Smith. Our music is by Martin Ostwick, and our artwork is by Sam Gilby. Enjoy those shorter films, folks. We'll be back in a couple of weeks.
We're a proud member of the Stripped Media Network.